Well, good evening, everyone, here and online. So we've modified things again by adding a camera view of the audience and a camera view of me, and we've added an additional microphone. So there's two microphones facing the audience. So hopefully that addresses to a certain degree some of the sound issues to those of you that are on Zoom. Just keep in mind, it's not going to be perfect, and if some of you make comments, just try to recognize where the microphone is and maybe speak towards the microphone or just try to speak up. I will try to relay some of the comments or the questions, but the issue with that is that it takes time, and so we're trying to chew through a lot of material here. So let's try this and see how it goes, and if we need to add a fourth microphone, we can do that next week. So these are the classes that I'm preparing, God willing, for Winfield this year. And you guys are the guinea pigs. We're going to start going through the material and see how things kind of work out. If you're going to Winfield, don't worry. I'm sure they're going to be quite a bit different by the time we arrive there. And if you don't want to listen to Job again, then you can sneak into the back of the teen class where we'll be dealing with a different subject. I've said this before, and maybe a lot of you agree, that the book of Job was never my favorite book in the Bible. In fact, we did the Bible readings at home. I actually hated to read the book of Job. And part of the reason for that is it presents itself as very complicated. And really, it presents itself as complicated because there's so much dialogue, and it's very difficult to understand who's speaking, unless you have good headers in your Bible. It's difficult to understand what's being said, and trying to determine whether those that are speaking are saying things that are actually truthful or not is also very, very difficult. One of the things that was very helpful for me, and I've said this before, but here's kind of the first tip, and we'll try to have some tips as we go through these different classes, is don't read the book of Job from the King James or from the Authorized Version, or have that with you as you go through if you have notes. I think the best version to read it from is the ESV. If you have the NIV, sure, read it from the NIV. Just realize that the NIV is going to translate sons of God into angels, and so you're going to be reading, and the angels came before God, and so that creates a bit of an issue. But use a more modern translation. The reason is because it really cleans up the dialogue and the text, and it helps you understand the things that are being said and who's speaking. Now, I'm not an expert on the book of Job. I'm not sure anyone really is. I've been studying this on and off for about 5 years in detail, maybe in the last year, and in a flurry of activity in the last 6 months as I try to, you know, prepare for this series. But there's so much to know and understand in the book of Job. It's not just a singular topic. There's so much going on that that's also one of the reasons why it can be confusing to go through, because you're trying to figure out, well, what's going on in this book? What's it really about? You have five main characters, plus you have God, plus you have the adversary. You have all kinds of conversation. There's complaining, there's arguing, there's griping, there's mourning, there's crying, there's weeping, there's yelling, there's screaming. There's just all kinds of emotions that are going on in the book of Job. However, I've now come to love the book of Job, and I think, God willing, as we go through it, hopefully you'll start to understand a little bit more about it and hopefully start to like what you read and like what you learn from the book of Job. As always, I welcome your comments, feedback, questions, anything. I sent out that email and get any questions sent back. So I'm assuming you guys know everything about the book of Job, and that's fine because you can help me get through this. But I will ask questions. There will be opportunity to make comments. For those of you who are on Zoom, you can chat them in. I'm not sure, Jeremy, if you're on Zoom, but I'll see them pop up here, or we can try to get to them. Or you can speak out, and we can hear you in here as well. So let's move on. The way that the talk series is broken down, so we're going to have three classes over the next 3 weeks, and then two classes, God willing, in the new schedule that comes out in July, where we'll kind of finish things off. And I've broken them down into five parts. What we're going to deal with tonight is the dismantling of Job. That's class one. Class two is the friends of Job. Class three, we'll talk about the righteousness of Job, because there's a lot going on, not only from God, but also from Job in that regard. Then we'll look at the God of Job and try to understand what was the vision of God that Job had Did the God of Job, does that match the God that we know and understand from the scriptures? And I think we'll find that it does not. And then finally, in class five, God only will look at the restoration of Job, where we know in the end of the story is very positive. And so that's how the five classes will break down. I'll start with a question. Just give me a soundbite, one or two word answers. What's the book of Job about? What do you think?
Education.
It's about education. It is definitely about education. The education of Job, but also other people. Thank you, Matt, to break the ice there. Anyone else? What's the book of Job? What do you think the book of Job is about, Peggy?
It's about transition from self-righteousness.
Excellent. Very good. Star people. 5 points.
Patience.
It's about patience, the development of patience. We hear that coming from James when he talks about Job. Have you heard of the patience of Job? And we'll kind of understand as we get through, because early on, Job has no patience. Later on, he does. Anyone else?
Selflessness.
Selflessness from online. Yes, absolutely. That's a great one. Sandra?
Understand
our relationship with God. Dad put his hand up at the back.
Suffering.
We learn a lot about suffering. Excellent. All great answers. And I would say, yes, those are all true. Here's a few that also that I'll add. The book of Job is about judgment and about judging other people. Because that happens with Job's friends. It's brutal what they do to Job. It's about understanding God. We heard that. It's about humility. In fact, I think one of the key things that we learn from the book of Job is that we need humility in our lives. It's about understanding the bigger picture, because Job was so focused on the minutiae of his life and how massive and awesome he thought it was that he couldn't see the broader picture of what was going on in all of creation. And that's what God starts to talk to him about in the latter chapters. It's about envy and how envy can destroy you and how envy does destroy the adversary. It's about dealing with trial. We've heard that. It's about learning how to trust in God. It's about developing faith. But I think if we were to get the most out of the book of Job, we have to put ourselves in Job's shoes. We have to think that the book of Job is actually about us. And I learned this in doing the study of Peter. I started to realize that Peter was just like us. He's just a regular guy that went through all the same issues that we go through. And although we might see Job as this maybe untouchable, super righteous, super wealthy man, he was those things. He struggles with all the same issues that we struggle with. Our misunderstanding of God, the unfairness of life when we suffer trial, the issues that we go through in the development of our faith, how, you know, we become good friends and good comforters. All those things, God willing, we will see as we go through this particular book. And the one thing that we'll see about Job and the major issue that he has is he had this elevated view of himself and a very depreciated view of God. Now that might sound very harsh. Now the handout that we sent out last week, there's a lot of verse snippets and it's divided up into columns so you can kind of see there, what did Job think of God? What did the friends think of God? What was God's view of himself and his righteousness? And it kind of lays out all the verses, and there's tons of information there. You look at those verses, you start to understand Job had a ton of issues and a ton of problems. But I think the wonderful thing about the book of Job, God willing, we'll learn, is that when we go through trial, we not only learn about the limitations of our own character, but we learn about the infinite nature and character of God, which is what Job had to go through. And that God is willing to bless us more in the latter days than in the beginning, which is an allegory, one of the allegories that comes out of the book of Job. And so I think all these things, God willing, will come out. So let's take a look at this first class on the dismantling of Job. And I look with horror, it's already 20 after. This is going to be a mess of timing tonight. Well, what does the word dismantle mean? Anybody know? Why is this first class about the dismantling of Job? Why is that important to understand? Sandy?
And taking apart?
Yeah, actually, I'm not trying to sound big-headed or anything, but I had to look it up. But the word dismantle is actually a French word, dismantel, which means to defortify. And I think it's important to understand that what God is going to do, and we see it happen actually in the first two chapters, is he defortifies Job's defenses. Job has this huge defense all around him of all the stuff he has, all his material wealth and his spiritual wealth and all these things. And God needs to strip all those off. And I think we'll find that, God willing, by the end of this particular chapter. And one other thing, and I guess these are all preambles, is for each class, I'm going to pose three questions. And that helps me kind of focus the material and hopefully helps everyone get an outcome out of this. And the three questions that we're going to try to answer today is, who was Job? Who is the adversary? And the broad understanding of why does God allow suffering? And in the next class, next week, we're going to look specifically as to why Job had to suffer, but we'll look at it kind of in this broad sense. So who was Job? Who was the man Job? What do we know about him? Throw a few things out. And we're in, by the way, we're in chapter one of Job.
He's rich.
Okay. Let's look at where he came from and the possible lineage of Job. Now, there's a lot of information on Job in the book of Job, but very little on Job in terms of the lineage. There's a fair amount of the other, of the three friends and of Elihu. But if we kind of piece it together, we can figure out pretty accurately what time frame and what lineage these men come from. So I'm going to go back to Genesis chapter 36. We're just going to just look at a few things. We're not going to look at all these verses that are listed there because that would take too long. Just to try to establish two things, actually three things. Where does Uz come from? Where does Job come from? And where does Eliphaz come from? So Genesis 36, and if we start at verse 8, it says, so this is now dealing with the lineage of Esau. So we can be pretty clear that Job and most of his friends actually came out of the line of Abraham and down through the line of Esau. Verse 8, thus dwelt Esau in Mount Seir. Esau is Edom. That's the first thing to remember, of course. We know that. Esau is Edom. These are the generations of Esau, the father of the Edomites in Mount Seir. And these are the names of Esau's sons. So one of Esau's sons is Eliphaz. So Eliphaz, the sons of Eliphaz are Teman. So we know from Eliphaz that he was a Temanite. Now this is not Eliphaz that we're talking about here. This is probably Eliphaz senior. Okay, in verse 11 of Job, of Genesis 36. Then there's Teman. And then the lineage falls off and we don't have Eliphaz junior here, but we can probably surmise that he either follows after Teman or maybe was one generation after that. And he identifies as a Temanite. So then you go down to verse 15. Okay, so that kind of sets the stage for Eliphaz. You go down to verse 15 and it says, these are the dukes of the sons of Esau. So the sons of Esau became rulers in their own right. The sons of Eliphaz, the firstborn son of Esau, Duke Teman and Duke Omar. And I'm reading here from the King James, Duke Zepho and Duke Kenaz. So it starts to give us an understanding that in the land of Edom, there were these little empires that came out of the lineage of Esau. And if you go down again, you find in verse 28, it says, the children of Dishan are these, Uz and Aran. So there's this man Uz. He starts his own city. And that's where Job is from. From Uz in the land of Edom. Okay, so that gives us some context of what's happening with these men. Now, if you go down to verse 31, this is a potential Job, but I would not be dogmatic on this. And these are the kings that reigned in the land of Edom before they reigned any king over the children of Israel. And Bela, the son of Beor, reigned in Edom, and the name of his city was Dinhaba. And Bela died, and Jobab, the son of Zerah of Bozrah, reigned in his stead. Now, there is some commentary that says that this might be Job, and we don't know for sure, but it fits in the time frame. It fits in the location of in and around Uz in Edom, and it fits in the lineage that we believe Job comes from, coming from Abraham down into Esau and down the line. So if you want that list of verses, I can give it to you. There's actually a little chart here that actually Neville Clark put together. And that kind of shows the potential lineage as we come down from Terra, Nahor on the one side, which we believe we can trace all the way down to Elihu. And then through Abraham, you've got Zophar, Eliphaz, and potentially Job. And then through Shua, which is one, another one of Abraham's wives, you have potentially Bildad. So if you want those verses, we can get there. I don't want to spend too much time on it because I think it's a point of interest, but I don't think it's necessarily important in our understanding of this man, Job, only in the sense that we can pretty much figure out where he came from. He was a real man, and he lived in this particular area. And it does help us hone in on the time frame, and we'll get to that in just a second. So when you look at the location of Uz, we already know it's in Edom. We already know that Edom was southeast of Israel. And one interesting commentator noted that if you say, okay, well, why does the narrator say that Uz is east? So east of what? Well, at the time, the biggest nation on the earth would have been Egypt, and a lot of things are relevant to the location of Egypt. So Uz would be potentially east of Egypt, and you draw a line right across, you can see on the map, some of the major areas in Egypt, there at Goshen, you go right across, you have Edom, and so we can be pretty sure that Uz is in that particular general area. And we've already talked about Uz descending from Esau, forming his own city. And Uz is actually mentioned in a few other places in Lamentations and also in Jeremiah. And then if you look at what happens in the dismantling of Job, the Sabaeans who come in and take the oxen and the donkeys and slay the servants were also in that area at that time. So that just gives us a little bit more evidence. And there's other things. So the question is when then would we place the time frame of these events that we find in the book of Job? So definitely after Abraham, but yeah, so because we would have Eliphaz, you can pretty much figure out as five generations from Abraham, if we follow his lineage. So it's after Abraham. And in the book of Job, there's no specific mention of the law of Moses at all. He is a priest, and he does offer sacrifices and pray, but that was happening way before the law, right? I mean, that happened with Melchizedek. We have the mention of the fall of man. That's in the book. There's an allusion to the killing of Abel by Cain. There's a reference to the flood. So it's after all of those events. There's even allusion, it seems, to the destruction of Sodom, and that's Abraham time. So it's definitely after that. And as I mentioned, Eliphaz, pretty clear, is fifth of Abraham. So I think you could roughly say, and this is me looking at other commentators as well, that Job's time frame is probably after Joseph, but while the nation is still in Egypt, and before the law was formalized after Joshua entered the land. So the time frame there that we can probably get pretty accurate on. But again, it's not, you know, super critical that we know the when, but it is a point of interest. There's another little close-up map of where Uz potentially is. And again, if you want all these verses, I can make those available. That's pretty easy. So as I said at the start, we need to kind of get into the shoes of Job and understand a little bit more about what Job was like. So if you're in chapter one there, we're given a ton of information right away about Job. There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright, one who feared God and turned away from evil. And then it goes into his material substance. So look at his material substance. He had seven sons and three daughters. Now, what does seven mean in the Bible? The number seven? Completeness. And what about three? Also completeness. And 10, what does the number 10 mean? It means like the ultimate form of completeness and order and authority, apparently. So you've got in his family this statement from God that this man had everything going on. His family was complete. He had 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels, another 7 and another 3 and another 10,000. He had 500 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys. So I went through this and I thought, okay, well, what's Job worth? Because, you know, we have members in our broader community that are wealthy. That's not Job. Job is like super wealthy. You know, if you look up I just looked up what a camel's worth. Anybody know it? Like, it's just like today. If you just, you look up camel, you want to buy like a good, healthy trading camel that's going to like travel. They're worth like $25,000. Well, he had 3,000. So you start adding these things up. You figure out pretty quickly that if he also owned land, so all of his animals, $50 million, easy. If he owned land, which he probably did, in today's valuation, let's just say double that, $100 million, right? So he's a farmer. He's a trader. You don't have 3,000 camels unless you're trading, right? And you're sending spice or grains or whatever, and you're using, it's like he had a huge trucking business, right? He had a massive farm, he had a huge trucking business, and he distributed stuff, so he was definitely a trader. And he's also called in the book of Job a prince, actually calls himself a prince. So he's, as I mentioned at the start, probably a ruler. He's also spends time at the gate of the city, right? And he dispenses judgment. So he has all the trappings of somebody who's actually in charge, politically connected, probably a ruler, has a massive family. He's super wealthy, like $100 million today. That's massive wealth, right? I don't think we have anybody in our community, maybe one or two, that have that kind of wealth. And that's not the problem. It's just that we're given this extreme representation for a reason. We're going to talk about that in just a second. So there's the material substance of Job. As I said, likely a prince, a ruler, trader, farmer, landowner. And as I said, you know, worth probably $100 million in today's money. So more importantly, of course, is the spiritual substance of Job. So what does it say about this man? Job 1 verse 8. This is God, or the angelic representation of God, more likely. Says in the conversation with the adversary, have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him on the earth. A blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. And when you look at what's repeated, because the narrator says it first, then God says it again, we have probably one of only three men in the entire Word of God that's represented with this kind of spiritual substance. So Abraham, right, is called righteous. Moses is described as being meek and righteous and faithful. Joseph is not presented with any flaws. Hezekiah is called good and right before God. Daniel is presented as a very, very faithful man. And it says Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. And probably the closest to Job would be Noah, because he's also called righteous. He's called a just man and is perfect in all his generations. And it says of Noah that he walked with God. So Noah was probably the greatest man spiritually before the time of Job. And God picks Noah, of everyone that was on the earth at the time, to have him and his family be saved. And we often forget, continue the generations of man after the flood. So Noah was a very, very amazing character. And so Job is right up there with Noah. Now turn to Ezekiel 14 and 14, because we also have other inspired writers that commentate on what Job was like. Now this is Ezekiel speaking of the sins of the house of Israel, right? So that's the context. How could the sins of Israel, how could Israel be saved? And it says in Ezekiel 14 and 14, it says, though these three men, Noah, Daniel, and Job, were in it, they should deliver but their own souls by their righteousness, says the Lord God. And a little bit further on in verse 16 and then in verse 18, it says, interestingly, they should deliver neither sons nor daughters. And we know that Job didn't deliver his sons and daughters. They were destroyed. That only they shall be delivered, but the land shall be desolate as we know it. So Job, not able to deliver his own sons and daughters, as righteous as he was, and he's placed in that, in the pantheon of Noah and Daniel. Now turn over to James 5 and 9, because this was the reference that I think was Marty that brought up about his patience. But listen to what it says. James 5, starting at verse 9. It says, "Do not grumble against one another, brethren, so that you may not be judged." And that's an interesting commentary, I think, on what we'll find out about the friends of Job. "Behold, the judge is standing at the door. As an example of suffering and patience, brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord. Behold, we consider those blessed to remain steadfast. Have you heard of the steadfastness of Job? You've seen the purpose of the Lord, how the Lord is compassionate and merciful." So to be, you know, mentioned again in the book of James, speaking about his faithfulness, his patience, and his steadfastness, also points out the stature of this man. So we've got to move on. Otherwise, we're never going to get out of here on time. So here we have this seemingly perfect man. He has this mountain of material substance, worth more than probably anybody that anybody knows here. And it's interesting that that's placed in this book. And he has a mountain of spiritual substance. I guess you could say he's like the perfect Christadelphian. Because not only does he have wealth, but he uses it wisely. And we'll find that out later on in the subsequent classes. He helps people. He trains people. He saves the widow. He gives money away. He dispenses wisdom. So he uses his material wealth very wisely, and he uses his spiritual wealth very, very wisely. So as God says, there is none like Job in all the earth. Very interesting. So let's just kind of recap here. Who was this man, Job? He's a descendant of Esau, probably his great-great or great-great-great-grandson. He lived about 5 generations from Abraham. Very rich in both material and spiritual substance. He was most likely a farmer and a trader and a landowner, and was very influential, probably a ruler, certainly calls himself a prince, lived in the southeastern portion of Israel. By the way, that's like kind of southern Jordan in today's location, in Uz and Edom. Very interesting man, and this very interesting picture. So now let's answer this second question. Who is the adversary? And I think understanding who the adversary was is way more important than understanding where Job came from or what was the time frame that we find Job in. And hopefully we'll find that out in just a minute. So let me ask you, who do you think the adversary is?
Jealousy.
Okay, that's the attribute. Yep, that's good feedback. So it was an adversary that was driven by jealousy. Okay? Anyone else?
Lack of faith.
Lack of faith, certainly on the part of the adversary. But the question is, like, who was the adversary? What was the adversary?
A neighbor or a brother.
Oh, you guys are way ahead. You guys are way ahead. Well, typically there's 3, or I guess potentially 4, different adversaries that could be presented. The first one that other churches will present is that the adversary is Satan, is actually a supernatural devil that comes upon Job to try to tempt him away and pull him away from his God. Now, we know that to be doctrinally incorrect, so we're not even going to present that as a possibility here, because it's just not scriptural. And so here's a tip, and this is another tip when you're reading through Job, is don't read Satan in the text. Cross it right out. Comes up a number of times, just cross it out. And write in the Hebrew meaning for that word Satan, which is either adversary or opponent or accuser. That's exactly what the word in the Hebrew means. And I say that as a tip, because then once you start reading it, you get this thing Satan out of your head, which is this kind of ethereal kind of thing that's hard to kind of nail down, and you realize, oh, this is an adversary. So let's look at these 3 possibilities that are left. The first one is an allegorical adversary. And we'll go through these because I think we got to kind of remove what it's not so we can better understand what it is. So what's an allegory? Well, an allegory is like painting a picture with a story, and use words and that story interprets things, meanings. So, for example, moral meanings. So, you know, much of the parables, for example, were presented as allegories, right? They weren't necessarily, well, they would have been based on real things, but they're presented as allegories. The Song of Solomon is an allegory of Christ and the Ecclesia. And there are other books in the Bible that present us allegorical pictures so that we can learn things and understand things from them. I do not believe that this is an allegorical adversary for a few reasons. Number one, because Job is presented as a real person. That's why God gives us lineages. He doesn't give us the complete lineages, I think on purpose, but he gives us enough to know that we don't just have this man Job that we can't track down. Are these friends, we don't know who they are. They're there. They're there in the line of Esau. Also, we're given a real set of events. And we're given time frames. So, for example, all of the calamity comes upon Job in the first wave in one breathless day. Right? And then we know that the friends came and sat with Job for how long? 7 days in silence. So we're given these time frames for a reason, so that we know this is not allegorical. It's not a parable. It's not just some story that's been used to teach a lesson. It's a real series of events. And yeah, there's spiritual and I guess you could say philosophical looks at human nature and different things, but we're presented with a record of a man that we can identify in the record, real friends that we can identify, suffering that actually happens, timelines that are real. And so an allegorical adversary to me doesn't make any sense at all. And also because the adversary presents itself with real issues, some of them that you've already pointed out. So what's next? Well, it could be angelic. Now, there's a lot of people in our community that think that the adversary is angelic. And I personally do not believe that that is correct. And I'm going to give you 7 reasons why. First is doctrinal. It is very dangerous territory if we start believing that angels can undermine the righteous and destroy them. That is not what angels are for. And we'll look at a few verses in a second. It's just one step away from believing in a fallen angel that becomes this supernatural being that then stands in opposition to all of those who try to seek God. Number two, although there are instances in the Bible where angels do stand in opposition to people, it is always at God's direction. So what's one example of an angel standing in opposition to a person / donkey? Right, with Balaam. But that angel was sent by God for a specific mission, which was to turn Balaam away from his particular task. Number three, there are angels that judge people and bring destruction. You think of Sodom and Gomorrah. But again, it's at God's command and for God's specific purpose. I guess 3A is this angel has, or if it's angelic, they have no power, because 7 times in the text in Job, it says God brought all of these things. Job says it, the 3 friends say it, Elihu says it, and God himself says it. Done. You could look at the term sons of God. Now, sons of God is used 5 times in the Bible, 2 times in Genesis, both humans. Okay, so for example, Genesis 6 and 2, that the sons of God saw the daughters of men, that they were fair, and they took them for wives of what they chose. Right, those are the two occurrences in Genesis. And then 3 times in Job, and that's it. 5 times in all of the Bible. Now, the 2 times in Job are when the sons of God, sons of men, come before God in chapter 1 and chapter 2. And then again in Job 38 and verse 7. And Job 38 and verse 7 is a little bit more obscure. Just turn that up, because it is used as an example that maybe this adversary is angelic because of what Job says. So this is Job speaking, Job 38 and verse 6. And he's speaking of this picture, this vision. He says, whereupon are the foundations thereof fastened, or who laid the cornerstone thereof when the morning stars sang together and the sons of God shouted for joy? So there you could say that maybe that is an angelic reference to the sons of God, but it's really not that clear. And that's it. Those are all 5 times. So clearly 4 of those 5 times, they are humans, referred to humans, in conversation with God or the angels. Number five, the term son, which is that word, you know, Ben, so Ben-Hadad or Benjamin, right? Ben in the Hebrew means son of. Almost every single reference in the Old Testament to the use of the term sons are human sonship or human lineage, okay? And that the root word for Ben means to build in relation to children. So that's what that term means and what it's used for. I don't know if you're convinced yet. Number six, Hebrews 1 and 14, verse we know very well, says, in reference to the angels, are these not all ministering spirits that have been sent to serve those who are to inherit salvation? So in reference to the saints, that's what God has the angels for, is not to destroy or undermine, but to actually help us and save us and bring us to salvation. And number seven, if we really look at the adversary in Job 1 and 2, it's not just an adversary to Job. In actual fact, it's an adversary to God. Probably more so an adversary to God, because this adversary comes before God and says, you know that Job? He is not what you think. And I'm going to prove it. I bet you if we take away all his material substance and his health, he's going to turn on you. That's an opposition to God. And we know no angel ever stands in opposition to God. So those are my seven reasons, and there's probably more. And as an aside, by the way, you probably know this, but after the end of chapter two, you never see the adversary again. And I think there's a reason for that. We'll look at that in some subsequent classes. So that leaves us with one final possibility. I believe this is what it is. I believe it's very clear that the adversary in Job is a human adversary. You know, Jeremy pointed out that jealousy was the motivation. Envy was the motivation of this. The primary motivation is envy and jealousy. Angels don't possess that, but humans do. And sadly, oftentimes we possess it in great measure. Now, this is not one of Job's three friends. Now, how do we know that the adversary, if we believe it's human, is not one of the three friends? It's kind of a logical outcome here. Do the friends know why Job is suffering?
No.
They don't. I mean, they think it's his sin. But if they were the adversary that came to present and challenge God to test Job, then they would know that, and they don't. So I think we can just remove them from it. And it's not Elihu, because Elihu is actually on God's side for this. Now, we don't have time to go through this because we're very quickly running out of time here. But there's lots of verses where men are adversaries in the Old Testament and the New Testament. And I can provide those. There are lots of examples where men actually appear before God's representative. For example, a priest or one of the angelic representations of God, and actually bring claims to them. So we see that in Deuteronomy 19, 2 Chronicles 19, 1 Samuel 10. There's a lot of different examples where men actually come before God and represent things or bring claims to God. So that happens quite a bit. The adversary disagrees with God's assessment. We've already talked about that. That's contrary to anything you would see in the Bible about angels. And the adversary's whole attitude is jealousy, envy, it's cynical, it's resentful, it's antagonistic, and these are all human emotions. Now, I want to talk about envy for a second, as my animation comes up on the screen, just to kind of prove my point. It's not the first two, it's the last one. You see that? I can do that again. There we go. Okay. I spent a lot of time on that, so I just thought I'd show it to you. This is why it's important that we understand who the adversary is, because human envy is a deadly problem. And if that's the case in the book of Job, then we have somebody in Job's community, Job's ecclesia, that hates Job enough and doesn't understand Job well enough that they actually want to see them fail. Now, there's lots of examples, excuse me, of human envy, and how it can destroy not only you if you possess that particular problem, but also the person that you intend to undermine. Now, James talks about this in James 3 and 16. He says, where there is envy, there is every vile practice. We see that with the adversary in Job. We see that with Cain. So what was Cain envious of? With Abel. Anyone online? Because the group in here is kind of tired.
He's envious because what he brought before the Lord wasn't accepted as well as.
And was Abel's?
Yeah.
Yeah, Abel did everything right. And that's one of the problem with envy is it's not necessarily born of some logical process. It's actually illogical usually and irrational, because if Cain brought the right thing, if Cain just listened to God and brought what God had asked, he would have been accepted. Abel didn't do anything wrong. He didn't goad Cain on. He didn't say, I'm not going to give you anything. You know, you bring your fruit of the land. I'm going to bring the sacrifice. None of that happened. Abel just did the right thing. And Cain was envious of it. And Cain murdered his brother because of envy. That's how bad this can be in our lives if we let that come in. What happened with Joseph's brothers? Why did they sell Joseph, throw him into a pit, and then sell him to the Midianites, and then send him off into Egypt? Because they wanted to, toughen him up a little bit. They were envious. They were jealous of him. He was the favorite son. Jacob made him a coat of many colors. We're going to talk about Joseph in just a little bit. And envy is often a result of guilt. And it can happen this way. And I'm not saying we have this issue, right now in our ecclesia. But I think at some point in our lives, I think we all get touched with a little bit of envy or jealousy. Think about the adversary in this particular case. Do you suspect that the adversary was also doing everything right? He was wealthy and had much spiritual substance? Or do you think this is an adversary that is not successful or not contributing to the ecclesia or not being helpful, not using his resources in the right way, and is trying to figure out a way that he can undermine the very person who was? And that oftentimes is a result of guilt. Envy can oftentimes be born of guilt. An excuse for not doing the work yourself. And so you point out, well, look at them. They're just doing it because they're blessed. Right? Christ talks about this in the New Testament. He talks about, we see this rich person come in and we give them the highest seat of honor at the table. And the poor person, brother or sister, you just go in the other room. We do that because our human judgment process and how we evaluate people oftentimes is based on material presentation, not spiritual. Look at Samuel when he's trying to, work with God's hand to select the next king of Israel, right? And the first son of Jesse comes, and big strapper was his name. Who's the first son of Jesse? I forget. Elihu? Sorry. Anyway, he looks at him and says, big, strong, good looking guy. Maybe it's him. God's like, it's not him. Next one, not him. Well, who's left? Oh, well, there's David, but he's out in the field. Samuel says, you got to bring him. Right? Because we judge with our eyes. We don't judge with spiritual perception. I think this is a huge particular issue. We have all kinds of these examples. Jacob and Esau, Rachel and Leah, right? Saul and David, even the elder brother and the prodigal son. These were issues of envy. And look what happened in the case of Saul and David. I mean, it was a disaster. So we've got to be very careful, brethren and sisters, that even in our community where we know each other, we probably don't know each other well enough. And if you don't know your brother and sister well enough, you will make assumptions about them, about what they're doing or what they're not doing, or when they don't show up at the meeting, where are they? Or when they buy a new car, or when they move, or when they go traveling, or when they go somewhere, you're going to make judgment calls about it. It's human nature to do that, and we can't do it, brethren and sisters. We have to ascribe the right motivation to our brethren and sisters, and we have to stay clear away from this issue of human envy. So we've got 10, 15 minutes left. Let's look at the dismantling of Job. So Job 1 and 8, we understand now who Job is. Hopefully we understand who the adversary is. And the adversary comes before God, and Job is presented. Have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him in all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? And you notice, God doesn't mention his material substance at all. Just his spiritual substance. Look at the adversary. The adversary answered, the Lord said, does Job fear God for no reason? Have you not put a hedge about him and his house and all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possession has increased in the land. The adversary doesn't mention his spiritual substance at all, only his material substance. Again, that's why I believe this is human. It's interesting, how this unfolds. Think of this verse in 1 Peter 5 and 8. Be sober-minded, be watchful. Your adversary prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking someone to devour. Resist him. Be firm in your faith, knowing that the same kinds of suffering are being experienced by your brethren throughout the world. Now, we have Peter talking about those of faith that suffer, the adversaries that they have in their particular lives that are looking to devour people. That's the end result of envy and jealousy. Proverbs 6 and 34 says, for jealousy makes a man furious, and he will not spare even when he takes revenge. It's an insidious thing. So the adversary has these very human emotions, human issues with Job, one that knew Job, probably not close enough to know him really well, but close enough to see what he thinks he is. But God has plans for Job, we understand. God has plans for Job. He has plans for Job's friends. And God is actually willing to prove his point to this adversary. And I think this is a question that comes out, certainly a question that I had when looking at the book of Job, which was, why didn't God just say to the adversary, you're wrong. Job does not follow me and commit his life to me because I blessed him. Not true. He actually is doing it for the right reason. I mean, if that was the case, we'd have two chapters or maybe even one chapter of Job and it would be over. We didn't have 42 chapters of trying to understand how this all works out. And I believe the reason is that we need to see this idyllic individual come crashing down to the earth. And not only that, but God needs the adversary to see the same thing. I've heard this said from other commentators that are smarter than me. It's very possible that God is trying to convert the adversary. And through the example of Job, is going to give license to Job's suffering so the adversary can witness the dismantling of this man and see the outcome that God knew would happen in the end. But potentially, the adversary leaves the truth after the end of the second chapter. Now, I'm just supposing that. I'm not being dogmatic about that. Number one, we never hear from the adversary again. We never see the conversion of the adversary. And right at the end of the second series of dismantlings, we know Job's response is very, very positive. Let's just look at what happens to Job. In very rapid succession, and when you read the verses, starting at verse 14 of chapter 1, it's one after another. It's breathless. He hears about the calamity of losing his servants and oxen and donkeys to the Sabaeans, and then the next messenger shows up breathless, and now it's the fire of God has burned up his servants and his sheep, and then while he's breathless, the Chaldeans have taken the camels and killed the servants, and then in verse 18 and 19, wind destroys the house that his children are in, it collapses on him, and they're all dead. In what was probably less than 30 minutes, Job loses everything in his material world. Everything in his possession is gone. His family, most precious to him, they're all dead. His material wealth, everything that he owned, is gone. All of his servants, all of his camels, all of his oxen, all of his sheep, all of his donkeys. In this absolutely stunning reversal of fortune, where there's no other man in all of the earth that was like this man, he's dismantled in 30 minutes. Can you imagine the tragedy that unfolded with this man, Job? As long and slow as it takes us to build up our meager possessions, Job, I'm sure, took his whole life to build up what he had. He loses it in an instant. You know, some of you have heard the story that I'm not in any way comparing it to Job, but we had a fire at our house when we were living back east, and, you know, we lost pretty much everything that was in the house. But we had insurance, and we were able to buy it all back, and we had a place to go stay. In fact, a couple days later, we went on vacation because we had nothing else to do. But Job lost everything. He's got no insurance. There's no backup plan. There's nobody around that can bring all of this back to Job. And so I think it's dramatic. I think it's extreme what we're presented. And what is the response that Job has? Verse 20. He tears his robe, which is a sign of mourning. He shaves his head, which is a sign of shame in the Old Testament. And he falls to the ground and he worships God, which is a sign of humility. So Job's first response is very good. He's humble. He's conciliatory. And he's repentant. As our reaction needs to be when things fall upon us like they fell on Job. You know, our lives in the truth will be difficult. And if they're not, then I submit they're probably not living our life in the truth right. If the truth doesn't challenge us, challenge the very fiber of our nature, then we're probably not committed. Now, I'm not saying that we're all going to suffer like Job. But the trial of our life as we work through the issues of our character and develop our faith, we're going to be challenged. The truth will test our allegiance. Are we in allegiance with the world or are we in allegiance with God? God will test us on that. He'll challenge us in our faith. God will put us sometimes in the vice of life so that he might conform us to the measure of his son. And so our initial reaction needs to be like Job's. And what happens next? Job says, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away, and he blesses God. And in all of this, he does not sin or blame God in any way. That's very telling. Well, the adversary is not done. We move into chapter 2 of Job in verse 3. The sons of men come before God again, and the Lord says to the adversary, if you consider my servant Job, that there's none like him in all the earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil. He still holds fast his integrity, God says, although you incited me against him to destroy him without cause. Excuse me. The adversary answers the Lord and says, skin for skin, all that a man has he will give for his life, but stretch forth your hand and touch the bone of his flesh and he will curse you to his face. So he says, okay, you know what? Maybe you're right about his material possessions, but you know what? We afflict him with pain and suffering in his health, and he's going to crumble before you. I just want to show you just real quickly what this disease was. So it's most likely the same thing that came upon them in the eighth plague. They call it here in some versions the botch of Egypt. So look at this. It's actually too small on my screen here to read. Hang on a sec. It's a skin disease. So this is all from Job. It's a skin disease that covered his whole body. He was covered in ulcers with an intolerable itching. Disfigurement made him unrecognizable. When his friends came to see him, they didn't even know who he was at first. Sores bred worms and maggots were actually on his skin. His breath was pungent. It just, the smell of his breath just drove people away. His skin was black and all broken up. He had deep internal pain. He couldn't sleep. He had nightmares. He had fever. He was emaciated, failing eyesight, fits of depression, weeping. He was mocked by children because he looked so bad. And he sought refuge outside of the city in ashes, and he longed for death because he couldn't attain it. This is not somebody who had a mild version of COVID. This is a disaster. This is, some people say that this was potentially leprosy, but it's even worse than that. I mean, look at all those things that came upon Job. So this adversary said, you've got to hit him so hard that he wants to die. And that's what happened. This man loses all his material wealth. His entire family, except for his wife, and now has the absolute worst disease known to man, comes upon him. This was the absolute dismantling of this man, Job. Physically, and I submit psychologically. He's left with nothing. In fact, we know, of course, that he even loses his wife in this process because she tells him to curse God and die. And so it's this extreme example that we have before us. This super wealthy man, this super spiritual man that loses everything in a matter of days and loses his reputation. He loses his health. And why do you think we have this extreme example in Job? Why is it this dramatic? To show us that we can get through anything, I think that's a great answer.
Have faith in God, that's all we're going to have to
have. That if we can see this happening in Job, we would also have faith in God. But why is it this extreme? Why are we shown probably the best Christadelphian you've ever met in your life, materially and spiritually, and he is completely destroyed? Why is it that extreme? I think there's a specific reason.
I think, like as you said, so that we can't say that we've had it worse. But
I agree with you. I say, number one, none of us could ever say, I'm as good as Job.
Or I've suffered more than you.
And none of us could ever say, I've suffered more than Job. You just can't. Anybody in this room say as good, better than Job? There's no way. None of us are as materially successful, and God has never said of any of us, as wonderful as I'm sure you all are, that we're right up there with Noah and Daniel. And no one can ever say, I've suffered more than Job. And I think there's a reason for that, is because of some of the things that you have said. We have those in our midst who have lost loved ones. Job lost all of his family. There are those of us who have lost things in our life, our jobs, for example. I've lost my job twice. Job lost his entire livelihood with a zero balance in his bank account and no way to make money. We have those who have had ruined relationships. Job loses his friends, his family. People in his community can't even come and talk to him. He's disfigured. He's grotesque. His breath smells. His wife doesn't even want to be around him. We have those in our community that have health issues. Have you ever seen anyone sitting in ashes, scraping their body with a broken pot as worms crawled all over their body? It is extreme so that we can look at Job and go, this is unfair. This seemingly unjustified example of suffering, at least to Job, is, I submit, brethren and sisters, often how we experience trial. Now, I'll make a submission to you that oftentimes in our lives, we elevate ourselves. We exalt ourselves. And we take the things that we've done and the things that we've amassed, and we, in our own minds, sometimes think they're much greater than they are. And then when suffering comes upon us, sometimes some of us make a huge deal about it. But we're going to find out something about Job and about this thing called exact retribution. Because the other problem I think we have is that when we are blessed in our life, do we attribute it to God? When we are judged and suffer, you know, trial and pain in our lives, do we blame God? I think what we're going to find is that Job does both of those things. He believes that his material possessions and his blessings elevate him to a level where he should be impervious to pain and suffering. And so the first issue that Job has that we have to deal with is the unfairness of his suffering. Now, I've gone over time, so I'm just going to close off and we'll just move on to the third question next week, God willing. But I want us kind of all to think about the extreme example of Job. Just try to work through that in our head. And try to put yourself in Job's shoes. Try to get intimate and understand who Job was. Right? Build a relationship with him and understand him, because as we go through his suffering and his trial, we're going to feel really sorry for Job. We're going to feel very sad for Job and his situation. But also we're going to see that Job ends up learning a whole lot about his own character and about the character of God. All right, we'll leave it there for now.